This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I have visited at least 7 hospitals this morning and I still cannot find them. I have asked the police if they have an idea of where my uncle and children can be, but the police has been of no help. I am confused. I do not know what to do next.
That's Prosper Chindu, who lost track of his uncle and 2 children after they went to the Olimbi football stadium in Cameroon's capital. Details coming up. Also, Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, has dissolved his cabinet. These stories and more on Africa News tonight. We start with our top story. The streets of Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso, are calm a day after the military declared it had forced President Roch Kabore out of office. Hundreds of people have celebrated, with some calling for the Russian help in fighting militant extremists in the country. We get an update on the situation from reporter Henry Wilkins, who is in Ouagadougou.
Which is a large square in the center of Ouagadougou, where many protests and take place and demonstrations take place. There was a large gathering of, I would estimate, around 4,000 people who had come to celebrate the arrival of the new government. There were people waving Burkinabe flags, and crucially, there was one individual who was waving a Russian flag. So in neighboring Mali, in recent weeks, Russian involvement has become part of the mix in that country, where they have similar problems with security linked to, or insecurity linked to, Islamic State and Al-Qaeda armed groups. In recent weeks, the Malians have contracted the help of Russian mercenaries from Wagner, the private security group with close links to the Kremlin. So it was very interesting today to see people waving Russian flags at the Place de la Nation. They were denouncing French involvement in the Sahel, saying that French involvement, French involvement has not given them any security. One demonstrator shouted to me in English that they had had enough of France and that they hoped that Russia would be able to help them. So in terms of the what's happening with the former president, his exact whereabouts are still not known. The last we heard yesterday, it was reported by various international media that he was interned at a military camp, Camp Lamizana, where the mutiny started on Sunday. But whether or not he is still there, it's unclear. What is clear is that the former ruling party, the former ruling MPP party, issued a statement yesterday afternoon saying that either on Sunday or on Monday morning, there had been an assassination attempt against the former president, Roch Kabore. There were pictures that went across on there were pictures that appeared on social media and on major international media outlets of vehicles belonging to the presidential guard, which had bullet holes in the glass and in the bodywork of the vehicles, and also blood on one of the seats. So these images, coupled with the statement from the MPP, began to raise a lot of questions as to whether or not the president had been, or the former president had been, injured in this assassination attempt, and whether he was in good health. This morning, President Macron of France, he made a statement to reporters when he was attending a conference in France, and said that he was aware of what was going on in Burkina Faso. He condemned the coup, but said that he had been assured by the new leaders of the country that the former president, Roch Kabore, was in good health.
That was reporter Henry Wilkins in Ouagadougou. He also reports that the military leadership has not yet identified who will act as president in the coming days. Cameroon and the Confederation of African Football have ordered an investigation into last night's deadly stampede at a stadium hosting a match for the African Football Cup of Nations. The stampede of fans trying to enter the Olimbi Stadium to watch a match between Cameroon and the Comoros overpowered hundreds of police and left at least 8 people dead and 38 injured. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from...
A nurse tells scores of people crowded into the Misasi Hospital reception to ask about injured friends and relatives to be calm and socially distanced. He says the hospital in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, is still attending to 7 casualties of Monday evening's stampede at the Olembe Football Stadium. Among those looking for missing relatives is 27-year-old merchant Prosper Chindu, who lost track of his uncle and 2 children after they went to the stadium.
I have visited at least 7 hospitals this morning and I still cannot find them. I have asked the police if they have an idea of where my uncle and children can be, but the police has been of no help. I am confused. I do not know what to do next.
The stampede occurred when fans wanting to watch an Africa Football Cup of Nations or AFCON match between Cameroon and Comoros forced their way into the stadium, pushing past hundreds of police. Cameroonian authorities say 6 people died on the spot, while 2 others died on the way to the hospital. A government spokesman in a statement said 7 of the 38 injured football fans were in critical condition at Yaoundé's Central Hospital. Cameroon's public health minister visited the injured at the hospitals and said President Paul Biya has ordered victims to be treated free of charge. Cameroon national football team player Fai Collins, who was playing at the Monday evening match, says they are saddened by the loss of life.
I hope the authorities will take the various measures they need to take next time it doesn't happen again. Our condolences to the families that have lost. It's really sad. It's really, really sad.
President Biya and the Confederation of African Football have ordered separate investigations to determine the cause of the stampede. The stadium was authorized to have a maximum of 40,000 people, but authorities say there were an estimated 57,000 at yesterday's match. Last week, Cameroonian authorities said spectator turnout in stadiums was low due to the pandemic and regulations requiring proof of vaccination and a negative COVID-19 test results. To help fill the stadiums, Cameroon launched a campaign for fans to be tested and vaccinated, with several thousand getting the jab to watch AFCON, Africa's top football tournament. But Cameroon's Ministry of Sports and Physical Education says thousands more who refused the vaccine have been jumping fences and forcing their way into stadiums. Cameroon is hosting the Africa Football Cup of Nations tournament despite the ongoing pandemic and threats from separatists to disrupt the games. The AFCON Championship started on January 9 and will end on February 6. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
One of next Sunday's Africa Football Cup of Nations quarterfinals has been scheduled for the stadium, but has been shifted to Ahamadou Ahidjo Stadium, also in Yaoundé. In yesterday's matches, Cameroon defeated Comoros 2-1, and Gambia beat Guinea 1-0. You can get more AFCON coverage from the sunny side of sports. Listen at voanews.com or find the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, keep track of the latest on Sunny's Twitter feed at VOA Sunny Sports. The World Health Organization says COVID-19 cases have dropped significantly in Africa for the first time since the peak of the fourth wave that has been mainly driven by the Omicron variant. Newly reported cases fell by 20% in the week of 16th of January, while deaths dropped by 8%. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
The recent drop in the new number of COVID cases in Africa has raised hopes that the worst of the latest surge of the pandemic may finally be over. Mashidiso Moeti, who is based in Brazzaville, is the WHO's regional director for Africa.
I think the signs are that the fourth wave is receding in South Africa, as it is as well in the continent, apart from the uptick that we are seeing in some North African countries, which are going through what would be their winter season, so similar to the patterns that are being seen in some of the northern countries. And the government has taken the step of reducing the level of restrictions in South Africa.
The number of new COVID-related deaths has also fallen sharply, although those on the front line of the crisis say further monitoring is needed. Moeti explains.
I believe there's no way in which we could say the whole world is out of the risk and we lift all the measures, including the wearing of masks and social distancing and some of the public health precautions. We know that the context is different in different parts of the world, in different countries, and sometimes even within the same country in different places. I believe that we need to be very careful about declaring the lifting of such measures.
South Africa, where Omicron was first detected and which has accounted for the bulk of cases and deaths, has recorded a downward trend over the past 4 weeks. Only North Africa reported an increase in cases over the past week with a 55% spike. The World Health Organization says cases fell across the rest of Africa, where as of the 16th of January, there were nearly 10.5 million COVID-19 cases and more than 233,000 deaths. Public health experts say significant efforts are needed to ramp up vaccinations to reach a broad swath of the population. In 2022, an average of between 250 million and 300 million doses of vaccine will be available for supply each month. Viona Atuhebwe is Vaccines Introduction Medical Officer at the Africa Regional Office of the WHO in Brazzaville.
We have about 500 million doses that have been delivered to Africa from all sources and about 330 million doses that have been administered. The main roadblocks to vaccination has been hesitancy, the inadequate community engagement, reducing our ability to absorb these vaccines from the community level.
Atuhebwe says funding shortfalls are also to blame for causing delays in vaccination.
But we also have had issues with disbursement of funding to countries. It looks like, yes, we do have funding from donors, but the disbursement from global level to the countries has been an issue. But also the disbursement from national level, once these funds get to the treasury in the countries, to the sub-national level where things are happening, has also been an issue. Then we have also had a problem of short expiry of doses.
Halle Feldbaum is the head of strategy and policy at the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria. He spoke about the collaborative efforts to increase access to COVID-19 treatment.
I will say this will not be easy. We're learning the lessons from vaccines. The challenge is they will be in short supply. They are in high global demand, and wealthy countries are acting very quickly to secure those supplies. So without additional financing, we are all in a challenging place for those of us trying to support low and middle income countries with equitable access to tools.
So far, almost 10.5 million cases of COVID-19 have been reported in Africa and over 234,000 lives lost due to the pandemic. Ruben Chama for VOA News, Nairobi.
Vowing to confront all forms of lawless conduct by public officials, Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera has dissolved his cabinet. The French news agency AFP reported Chakwera was pressured to take this kind of drastic action because a week ago, two influential church groups that acts as a government watchdog expressed concern over the president not being decisive in fighting corruption. Last month, the Minister of Lands was arrested on bribery charges. Last month also, the former finance minister and ex-central bank governor were arrested on allegations they manipulated accounts to obtain loans from the International Monetary Fund. Chakwera won the 2020 elections by campaigning on promises to fight corruption in the poor southern African country. Ugandan authorities have released Arthur Kakawenza Rukira Vashanja on bail a month after his arrest for insulting the president's son, but on the condition that he and his supporters not speak to the media. As Halima Tumani reports from Kampala, his lawyer has alleged he was tortured in custody.
Ugandan writer Kakwenza Rukira Bashaija was today given bail after a month in detention. Speaking to VOA, his lawyer Aaron Kiza described Kakwenza's health condition as frail, saying he is a torture victim. His bail conditions include a ban on all parties and lawyers not discussing the matter in the media. He is charged with two counts of offensive communication against the person of the president, Yoweri Museveni, and his son, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba. Kakwenza was arrested December 30 after he tweeted calling Museveni's son obese, drunk, bad-tempered, and a rotting corpse of a future president. Kainerugaba is seen as a possible successor to his long-ruling father in Uganda's 2026 election. Kakwenza's detention was marked by his detention in an unknown location, allegedly by the military, and later reports emerged of him being tortured before he was transferred to a maximum security prison facility. In a tweet, Uganda's leader of opposition, Mathias Mpuuga, says when he went to visit Kakwenza in prison, he had healing scars and other marks of torture covered his body as he slightly limped into the room. He further shared details on the nature of abuse, saying that Kakwenza's fingernails had patches of blood caused by injuries during the torture. Kakwenza reportedly told Mpuuga that soldiers used a pair of pliers to pluck his fingernails and other body parts before being made to dance non-stop throughout the night and day as soldiers insulted and beat him. This was the third time the award-winning writer was arrested. The first in April 2020 for his novel, The Greedy Barbarian, a fictional writing of high-level corruption. His second arrest was in September 2020 for his second novel detailing torture titled Banana Republic, where writing is treasonous. He won the Penn Pinter Prize International Writer of Courage Award in 2021. Halima Othmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
It's been 11 years since the 2011 uprising began that resulted in the ouster of autocratic Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak amid demands for freedom, justice and human dignity. The Egyptian government says some progress has been made since that first protest rally on January 25th, 2011, but human rights organizations say the new regime has shown utter disregard for the rule of law and is cracking down harder than ever on dissent. Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of Research at Project on Middle East Democracy, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the situation in Egypt 11 years after its revolution.
First, I would say that I don't think any progress in the human rights situation has been made over the past decade. In fact, by all accounts, by all measures, the human rights situation in Egypt today is far, far worse than what it was on January 25th, 2011. So there definitely has been no progress made. And unfortunately, there have been many, many, many setbacks. As for why the situation is so bleak, there are so many factors, so many reasons why Egypt has ended up under a worse dictatorship today than what it suffered under the regime of Hosni Mubarak. I would just point to maybe one issue that I see as particularly important, and that's the strength of the repressive and authoritarian forces inside Egypt ended up being more powerful, more organized, and more shrewd than the pro-democracy forces. And the pro-authoritarian forces inside Egypt, who did not want a democratic revolution to succeed, not only were stronger and better organized inside Egypt, but they also enjoyed support from important countries in the region, such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And they also benefited from a weak and disorganized response in support of democracy on the part of the United States and Europe. So I would point to that factor as a key factor for why the events that occurred 11 years ago did not lead Egypt to democracy.
Freedom, justice, and human dignity city, Egyptians took these three central concerns to the streets at their first protest rally on January 25, 2011, 11 years later. Did Egyptians achieve some of these goals, especially at the socioeconomic level?
No, I don't believe that they did achieve these goals. On the political level, there was a brief 2.5 year period of democratic change, democratic opening in Egypt that was ended by the military coup in July 2013. So there was a brief period of political gains that were quickly reversed, unfortunately. As for the socioeconomic demands for dignity, for social justice, for better economic conditions, unfortunately, Egyptians did not achieve those. The economy, by many accounts, is as difficult, or by some measures, perhaps worse for the vast majority of Egyptians than it was under Mubarak. And a main reason for that is that the current government in Egypt is not very interested in prioritizing improving living conditions for most Egyptians. And so living conditions, day-to-day life, economic situation for most Egyptians has unfortunately gotten worse.
The Biden administration pledged to put democracy and human rights at the center of U.S. foreign policy. Was that promise delivered in U.S. policy toward Egypt?
A year into the administration of President Biden, we haven't seen, in my view, human rights put at the center of U.S. policy toward Egypt by any means. It remains a marginal issue with security issues, military cooperation, and other issues taking center stage. Regional policies, etc. Human rights continues to be marginalized in U.S. policy toward Egypt. The Biden administration has done a few things to push on certain human rights issues, I think more robustly, more strongly than certainly the Trump administration did. So far, these efforts have not borne very much fruit, but I will give the Biden administration some credit for pushing on these issues more robustly than had been done in recent years. However, we still have to see if these efforts will be strengthened and how much effect they will have on the human rights situation inside Egypt.
That was Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of Research at Project on Middle East Democracy, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Tropical storm Anna hit the east coast of Africa's largest island, Madagascar, last week, according to the French news agency AFP, with downpours causing flooding and mudslides that have swept away houses in the capital, Antananarivo. The latest report from Madagascar's Disaster Management Agency today indicates 34 people have died and nearly 65,000 have been left homeless. Yesterday, the storm made landfall on mainland Africa, bringing heavy rains to Mozambique's central and northern districts. Today, Mozambique's National Institute of Disaster Risk Management reported 2 dead and 49 injured in Zambezi province. Government and UN agencies estimate 500,000 people may be affected. The storm plunged most parts of neighboring Malawi into darkness after flash floods forced the electricity generation company to shut down. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays,